It's my utmost pleasure to welcome you to the last lecture of the pre-reinforcement learning course in this semester. Given that it's the last course, there are some official stuff which needs to be dealt with. So before I will let you ask, I will do some small number of announcements. First, now it's time to like look back at the course. So it was already, I think, the third repetition of the course, but still the course is evolving a lot. Well, I am learning new stuff as I go, and also the stuff is changing a lot in the area of reinforcement learning. So you can see that the course adapts, and some of the parts of the course are not finished to the level that they should be. Like the slides are sometimes missing. We'll see that some of them will once again be looking in the papers, and some of the assignments take long to prepare. But in any case, I'll be very much interested in some kind of feedback. So if you know what you liked, or if there are things which I think the course either more enjoyable or more approachable or easier or whatever, then by all means, please let me know somehow. Either you can tell me directly, or you can write me via our email, whatever, or we can talk about it on the practicals. But if you have something which you wondered, like why something works like this, or would it be nice to do something else or something, then please don't hesitate to tell me, because it will make the course better, at least for the other students. Also, you can use this poll, the student poll in the student information system. You can also write some details there, and I also like go through all of them. So if you want, you can also use that. Similarly, if you like the course, please fill the student poll in the student information system, because the poll results are one of the ways how the courses can be which gives some weights to the courses. So if we want the points to be like partially obligatory or voluntary obligatory or something, then it makes sense to like for the people to see that they actually liked. And if you didn't like the course, then also fill the poll, right? Because it can stir some changes which can make the course better or steered in a better way next year. So please fill it in all the cases. I promised the chocolates for the first three places in the competitions, and then I stopped giving them. The problem was that with the shop, I chose, there were some like problems, and the vouchers couldn't be used on the post prices and so on. So I stopped, but it doesn't mean you will not get your chocolates. So still everybody will get a chocolate, and instead I will buy all of them, and I will just make them available in Prague. So whenever you'll be able to get to Prague, you'll be able to get to pick up your like sweet reward for faring well in some of the competitions. They will also be available at the exams. So if you will go to an in-person exam, you can claim your chocolate there as well. By the way, there is like a Hall of Fame page on the Piazza, which shows the competition points of all the participants. So you can see how you well you did in this competition part of the lecture. I mentioned exams, so I think everybody is interested in exams. So given the situation, there definitely will be some in-person exams and some online exams. The faculty is strongly preferring the person exams, because it's not possible probably to make the online exams as good as the in-person ones. So generally the university wants the students to take the in-person ones, unless there are some non-trivial reasons which would contradict it, right? So saying I'm too lazy to get to go to the exam is not a valid reason, but I am in a different country is a valid reason. And also like I live like 200 kilometers away and I have no way where to live, where to spend night in Prague. That's also a good and valid reason why not to go to the in-person exams. But if you live in Prague or reasonably close, I don't know, like 1 hour drive, then the faculty will actually want you to get there in person. This will be reflected by the in the following way. There will be both the in-person exam dates and the online exam dates in the student information system, but you will be able to apply for the in-person ones as only, and if you want to go to the online exam, you need to write me an email saying why you need the online exam, and then I will subscribe you to this to the exam date. So it's a bit uncomfortable, but let this additional burden of actually being able to go to the online exam is there just exactly to motivate people to go to the personal one if they have like a reasonably good way how to do it. But even in the fifth degree of the anti-epidemic system, we can actually make personal exams if the number of participants is at most 10 and everybody sits far away from each other and so on. Yeah, there will be the same set of questions for the online exam and for the person exam, and the exact form of the online exam is still unknown, whether you'll write answers somewhere on paper electronically or whether it will be just an oral one. This will be somehow determined. Like as we go, but the set of the questions will be the same. The questions are not yet available on the course website, which you may have seen or realized. Well, that's because the new set needs to be prepared because of this new form of the exam, and I still wasn't able to do it. But it will be available at the beginning of the next week. This also means that the first the exams will actually not take place next week, right? You don't have the questions for them anyway, so they will start taking place from the second week of the examination period. By the way, the examination period was prolonged by 2 weeks, so it will be going until the end of February. As usual, like if you need some special treatment, not nearly everything can be arranged. So if you have some special requirements, don't hesitate to write me as normally. I also have a what next note here. So now you have absolved or nearly absolved the deep reinforcement learning. You probably also attended the deep learning course. So what next? Well, I previously had this deep learning seminar, which was cancelled this semester, as you know. But I want to start organizing some kind of a reading group, which then can be which you are all welcome to attend if you want. There will be no credits or nothing for it. It's really just a voluntary activity, and the idea is to keep the track with whatever is happening in the area of deep learning. Several first, I will write some specific dates or time to the Piazza, so all of you will have a chance to go if you want to. And I plan to spend the first two or three reading groups by extending our deep reinforcement learning knowledge. So to go through some more advanced paper, which we didn't get time to go through here on the lecture. There will be, of course, no practicals for it. The things will start to be quite difficult. But yesterday I found some number of interesting papers. I decided that I want to start the reading group by actually going through these. So the beginning of the reading group, like let's say two or three repetitions, will be more like lectures when I will prepare some presentations regarding these papers, and then we will see how it will evolve. I assume it will happen online, and the recordings will be available for download either just to the closed circle, probably just to the closed circle of people who are there. So that was probably all on my part. Are there any questions on your part? Doesn't seem so. So if not, but don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point, of course. Let's get to the topic of our last lecture. And that's explicit memory handling, or generally I could also say partially observable Markov decision processes. Most of the time we were talking about the MDPs with this Markovian property, but in the more advanced environments we don't really get access to the whole state, but instead we only observe some part of the state. So this can be modeled by this partially observable MDPs, where there is still a Markovian state inside, but the agent cannot really see it. Instead, they see just some observation given the state and the previous action, right? So if, I don't know, you are trying to navigate in a 3D maze, the state is the full state or the full map of the 3D maze, but you only see something. So if it is 2D one, then maybe you have some field of vision, or if it's a 3D one, you really just see the 3D view of whatever your agent is seeing, and so on and so on. So these partial observable MDPs are usually handled using recurrent networks. We already have seen the PAAC with LSTMs, and we have seen that this inclusion of like short-term memory, like in the R2D2 agent, helps a lot to plan across different time steps, and also to like aggregate knowledge from the previous time steps. So this is one way how we can deal with the partially observable MDPs. I will now consider settings in which we like our environment will be like some kind of a 3D visual environment. So the observation will be the image, right? And we also may get some textual input. So this is our environment, and let's say that we want to solve the tasks which are only partially observable. So I don't know, we are playing a memory game like a Pexisol thing, and you can see all the cards, but most of them are flipped the upside down. Or we are really in a 3D maze and we want to find the apple to have something to eat, or so on and so on. So we need to deal with this partial observability. So the simplest case is just to use an RNN to incorporate or include or remember all our past observations, right? So for this partial observable environment, so what we want to do, we want to model the policy, right, of our action, conditional on all the previous observations, and usually also on all the previous actions. Right, this is usually how it works. In order to do this efficiently, we use some RNN, and the RNN will start with some initial state, right? As or it's H, so let me do it H, some H zero, and then the HI will be generated using some RNN, LSTM, GRU, whatever, by using the previous time step, the observation, and the action which we performed. This means that HI is dependent on all the previous observations and actions. So then here the policy can easily be dependent on the HT minus one and OT, for example. So there's a visualization of this model, which comes from the Merlin paper, which is a paper which we will spend most of the today's lecture talking about. So we have the input environment. And now there is the part which will predict the policy, right? So get the OT, that's the observation, like all of these observations. So the images, maybe the textual inputs. We also include the reward from the previous time step and some kind of a value estimation from the current time step. So that's all our observation. What we will do is we will use some kind of an encoder and encode all this information to ET. And normally we would then compute the policy, right, like the distribution of actions given the state, or the state is this encoded observation. But because we want to include the previous memory, we have an LSTM cell here, which processes these encoded observations, right, so that it is able to remember all the previous states. Then we generate, like we can post-process the results, so we can like generate the final like hidden layer, which takes the ET, it takes the HT, and it generates distribution over the actions. Then we sample an action from it, and then we can continue, right? And this is a model which is, for example, the PAC LSTM, just drawn in a different, in this like specific way. And we can train it using, for example, and some actor critic algorithm. Yeah. However, for many environments, this LSTM doesn't have enough capacity to remember the required number of information. If we are talking about a 3D maze, then like remembering all the past images is very difficult, because we would need an extreme capacity. But the usual LSTMs, they have like thousand, like the dimensionality of small thousands at most, right? So we need to improve our storing capacity. So what we can do is we can use some memory augmented networks, some way of explicitly storing some additional information in the external memory, not explicit, sorry, but external. I assume that you went to the deep learning last year, so you know something about the neural Turing machines and differentiable neural computers or memory augmented neural networks. I will just like briefly mention how these architectures work, but what they allow us to like increase the capacity of this like memory module, or how to call it, substantially. This way we can store much more information and recall them from the memory whenever we need to. So it's for the memory module. So let's M be the memory, which contains some number of cells, and each cell has got the size of Z. The Z is the size of the value which we write to the memory. So that will be ET actually. And we actually do twice the size of it. Sorry, I'm just writing that I should change Z maybe into ET. So we have some number of cells with the capacity twice the encoded observation. We have a LSTM controller here, and the controller instruct us how to write to the memory and how to read from the memory, right? The output of the controller are the read keys and the, I don't know, like sharpening, like the weight or the temperature for the cosine similarity, which should be applied when using these keys. The LSTM itself, it takes like the observation state from the previous action, and also the state of the LSTM from the previous step, and we get these the read is the usual one. So we compute the cosine similarity between the keys and all the memory rows, multiply them by beta. So it means we can sharpen the distribution if we need to, pass through the softmax layer. So the betas are the inverse of the temperatures. And then we read according to these read vectors. As for the writing, we like in this specific situation, they don't let the network to decide where to write, and instead they just append all the information to the memory, right? So what we will do is we will store the memory in this first unused memory rows. If the environments are short enough, or the episodes are short enough, then it's fine to just never overwrite and just only append all the experience to memory. But if we want to solve some long environments, like playing Alpha Star or something, StarCraft or something, then we will need to track the memory cells which were the least used, so they were least written to and the least read from, and then we can use them just to be overwritten. The interesting thing, and then we like write this our state ET to that memory location, to the first half of the memory location. The new trick here is actually this second half of the memory cells, which is used for what they call retroactive memory update. The thing is that once you write to memory, you never update it. But when you write something to memory, maybe being able to observe what happened later, like combine these things together, might help us. So that's what they actually do. So if you write to some cell, then we keep the information that we have actually written to this cell. And in the future time steps, we update the second half of the memory cell by adding the new encoded observation. The weight of how we do this in the future gets like decreases by some exponential moving factor. So when we have written at time t to a cell, then we first write just to the first half, right? And then in the next in the next time step, we add the ET plus one to the second half of this cell, but multiplied by gamma, right? And then we also add et plus 2 to the second half of the cell, but multiplied by gamma squared, and so on and so on, right? So if when we have written to the memory, we also make sure that all the future changes are also like accumulated in the second half of the memory. So this gives you like an immediate connection or immediate link of how the episodes progressed given some memories. They say that their agents train even without it, but with it, it trains like much better. So this is the external memory part. So this is nothing terribly new. However, this doesn't work well. If you try it, you will see that the training goes either extremely slow or extremely bad, or probably both of them at the same time. So what we need to do is we need to find a better way of deciding what to write to memory. Like the thing is, the encoder here is trained purely by the reinforcement learning. So when we need to learn what to write to the memory, we only use the signal from the reinforcement learning, and that's all. And it might be extremely difficult to come up with some functioning or working way of like finding how to encode the inputs with just trial and error. Right? The gradients which go through the memory are also extremely long distance. And if the entries in the memory are not good, then the retrieval of the memory will not be useful. So a lot of things need to click in order for this memory mechanism to be actually of any use. So the authors of this paper, it's a Merlin paper, they propose to some approach how to do this, right? Not just update the memory and the encoder using just reinforcement learning, but doing it differently. They quote motivations from the neuroscience actually, and you'll get there. But before we get there, we need to talk about generative modeling a bit. I assume you have seen the VAE, right? The variational autoencoder. This is just a model which can be used to compute latent variables, which can be used to reconstruct the original input, right? So in the variational autoencoder, you have two parts. There is an encoder, which encodes the input to some latent variable Z, which can then be used to generate the original X. But what we usually want is the similarity of X's to be reflected by the similarity of the latent variables. That's one thing which we might want to. We might want to come up with a good representation of X such that it actually like reflects a similarity. Ideally, it would be some low-dimensional, or it could be some low-dimensional representation if the input is high-dimensional, but it lies on low-dimensional manifold. Then finding a better representation of that would be a good thing. And normally, this is achieved as follows. Like, let's say that we have got this model. There is this encoder here, the decoder here, and we want to find out how to we want to jointly train the encoder and decoder so that we can model the data. And if we do so, we can use the variation lower bound, that says that the likelihood of the data is bounded by the reconstruction loss, right? So the likelihood of the reconstruction given Z when the Z is sampled from the encoder, right? So the encoder generates the distribution, and if we then sample from the distribution and reconstruct the input, we want to get the original one. plus the KL divergence loss, which tells us that the prior on the latent variables is as close to the output of the encoder as possible. Like, I'm really fast forwarding through this because I assume that you have already heard about it. If not, then tell me. I'm just like repeating what happens. Like, there is some reason how you will get to this formulation. But the fact is that the sum of these two losses is actually a lower bound of the likelihood. So we can just use the maximum likelihood estimation, and we try to minimize these two quantities. So we want first the reconstruction to hold, and then we also want this Z to be distributed by some prior PZ, which, for example, allows us to generate new pieces of data by really sampling from the prior, right? Because the problem with this latent variable is that we actually want all the latent variables in the prior to correspond to some reasonable data, and this forces the model to actually like represent similar axes in the similar regions of space in the latent space because of this sampling procedure, right? And we can then use the reparametrization trick to actually backpropagate through this sample, and we train this expectation using one sample estimate and so on. So these are the variational autoencoders. However, sometimes we might generate not just one element, not just like one X, but a whole sequence. So assume that we have a temporal sequence of X's, and we would like to model them using the so-called variational recurrent neural network. So what we want to do is we want to so we have this situation. From the previous time step, we have some H which somehow summarizes all the information until this point, right? And what we will want is we will want to in the generative part, we want to create a new like latent variable, which will correspond to this time step. From that, we will generate the new time step. Right. So the prior Z for the latent variable is generated from the previous time steps. The data themselves are generated from the latent variable and the previous time steps. These allow us to define the age to like aggregate the history from the previous time step and from this time step, that's how like we can go forward. And during training we train this in the same way as in the variational autoencoder by using the KL the lower bound or the variational free energy. So the prior, there is an important difference here, and that's that the prior for Z is actually depends on the previous time steps. Like in the normal variational autoencoder, this PZ, this prior, is just like a standard Gaussian or something. Like it's some fixed distribution. However, in the temporal model, the priors on Z, they need to depend on the previous time step. So assume that the sequence which we are modeling are some digits written by one person. So let's say that this one person writes once in like very specific, weird, skewed way, right? So once you have seen two ones or something, then if you generate a third one, you should probably somehow like adapt or use the fact that the previous ones look like this. So it cannot be that this latent variable for this next element will be completely independent on the previous time step. No, on the other hand, it needs to have like the prior information about how this one will look like need to depend on the previous time step. So this PZ will not be a fixed distribution. Instead, it will be a distribution dependent on the previous time step. So that the factors or the representation will be consistent across the time steps, right? That's one of the motivations. Like imagine that we want to generate handwritten digits. What we need to do is we need to keep the style through the course of the whole generation. Right, so if we just do an RNN and then sample independently in different time steps, then you can see that the model will change the way how it writes throughout the generation, because it can like easily forget, because the prior in each time step is like independent on the time. However, if we do it correctly, you can see that the whole sequences tend to keep similar style because the priors in each time step are already influenced by the previous ones, right? So in the normal variational autoencoder, we say, okay, we want all the data to fill this specific part of the latent space. Here, when there is a time series, given that the previous time steps, we decide which part of the space do we actually want to use, right? So the prior can be just a smaller part of the space, which is consistent with whatever we have just seen in the previous time steps. Of course, at the beginning, like in the first time step, it will be likely the whole latent space, but it might get sharper after several time steps. So that's one thing. So our prior will depend on the previous time step. We will be able to generate axes. So the decoder will take the prior and also the previous time steps, right? That's the generative part of the model. In order to train this, we will also have an encoder. The encoder will allow us to produce the Z. The encode the input and the previous time step into the hidden variable, right? So in the usual VAE, we don't talk much about the prior, but here in the variational RNN, this prior is important and depends also on the previous time step. Then we have the decoder, which generates X's from Z's, and we need also an encoder, which generates Z's from X, and everything is conditioned also on the previous time step, right? And all these priors, encoders and decoders, factorize through time. So we perform the generation like step by step, right? So if you want to compute likelihood of the data given the Z, so if you want to decode it, we do it by considering the individual time step. So in step T, we generate the T-th output using the outputs of the previous time steps, which gets there via the HT minus 1, and the latent variables up to including that time step. During training, we use the variational lower bound. This time it's time step wise. So we once again include the reconstruction loss and the KL divergence loss. And in the KL divergence loss, we want the encoder to be close to the prior as possible. So we compute the KL divergence of this. And the difference to the normal VAE is that here, normally we would have just the PZ, which would be a fixed I don't know, N01, but here it's also a trainable prior. So this is the variational RNN, which allows us to come up with a nice latent representations of the inputs, right, which are probably low dimensional, but still try to keep the distances and the similarities as possible, as well as possible. But the new thing is that we can do it like consistently through the through some number of time steps. So now, maybe let's see some images before we get back. So this is a paper from 2017, I think, which extends the idea which we just talked about, but it's very similar. So we have the RNNs, we have the latent variable, we have the observed data, and this is the variational RNN model which they use. And what we do is we model sequences of handwritten digits, right? So in this paper they just like measure the losses on some number of the sequences, right? So it's like a generative model. So the model gets some number of inputs, and in each time step we measure the loss of actually producing that input. So we don't really let the model to do anything. We instant measure of how likely does the model think that the next input is. And there are various tasks. For example, in this, the so-called perfect recall task, we provide the model with some number of digits, and then we wanted the model to copy or repeat the digits from the beginning. Right, nothing extremely difficult, but I didn't switch off my phone. I'm sorry for that. I will do it immediately and make sure it will not ring at all. So what should probably happen? Well, once we are recalling the digits from the beginning, then the KL divergence should go down, so that the prior and the posterior should get closer together, which means the model should anticipate, like the prior should expect the digit to be the one which it has already seen, right? So you don't tell the model that these things repeat. You just train it and hope that the prior will learn to like be able to get closer to the posterior, because you actually know what should be generated, and you can see that really at some point the situation improves. The plain variational RNNs are not that great. You can see that the KL divergence doesn't really go down much, and the authors they propose some additional and that's because the vRNNs, they don't have the explicit memory, right? It's they just model the data with the memory of the LSTMs, which is fine for short sequences, but once the sequences gets larger, you can see that nothing really happens, right? So the yellow line like doesn't decrease. However, if we somehow incorporate external memory, either through NTM, neural Turing machine, or differentiable neural computer, all least recently used module, or the introspection module, which is something what they propose, then you can see that actually the even after longer sequences, the model can reasonably well recall the data from memory, but it's not like you copy the data itself. Instead, you measure all this in the latent space. Yeah. There are many other tasks here, but generally they show that the models like can do something, but depending on how you want to index the memory, the different mechanisms for learning the memory manipulations differ in a way which you would expect. So let's stop at this point and let's get back to the lecture. So now, if we can use our knowledge about the variation of RNNs to come up with a different way of training the encoder and the memory coder. Okay, I can see a typo there. I'm writing the page 6 to fix it right there. So in this Merlin model, we have the so-called memory-based predictor, which will be the part which will be capable of training the encoder and the memory content. So the policy itself will just use the existing memory and already pre-trained encoder, and it will just do some actor-critic training. And the goal of this memory-based predictor, MBP, is to find a good encoder. So compress the observations to some low-dimensional latent variable Z, and these will be then stored to memory. So there are some talks from the paper. The paper has really advanced discussion. What they say that they have taken some ideas or some thoughts from the so-called hippocampal representation theory. And the theory says that the representation in the hippocampus of mammals works by compressing the input stimuli such that these can be reconstructed together with the reward, right? So what they do in the paper is that they come up with a representation which is useful not only for reconstructing the original stimuli, which is something what a regular VAE would do, but also for the task reward, right? So if the model sees something is like in the brain, see something is good, maybe there is a dopamine somewhere in the brain or something, then this information gets also included in the compressive bottleneck. So how is this incorporated in Merlin? So the Merlin uses the model, which is quite similar to this vRNN model with external memory. So in each time step, we encode two distributions. One will be the prior over the latent variables, right? That's something which we will use as one part of the KL divergence loss. And this prior distribution predicts the latent variables conditioned on the previous time steps, but not on the observation, right? So this is the part of the model which will try to know what will happen instead of actually seeing it. So you can think about the prior as actually some kind of a model of the environment, right? Just using the action which we used, we hope to come up with a good latent representation of the state. And then we also have the posterior, which will correct the prior by using the new observation. Right, so this posterior, that's actually the encoder, right? So that's the encoder which will get us the encoding of the observation. So is there an image? Yes, there is an image here. So it gets to be a bit tricky. So here we have the encoded inputs, and now we want to represent them using some latent variables, Zs. This is the memory-based predictor. So this is somehow trained. This trained the encoder, among others. These sets, these representations, are then written to the memory, same as before. So we just write these sets directly to memory without giving the reinforcement learning part a chance to modify it. So what we write to memory doesn't depend on the RL part, on the agent. It only depends on this memory-based predictor. So it's this latent variable. So for working with the memory, we have several controllers. One controller is here, whose goal is to aggregate all the information for the prior and the posterior. Right, so this part, this one is like LSTM, which can use the memory, right? So in each time step, it generates some number of read keys, which are read from the memory and then used whenever it's necessary. And the goal of this is just to aggregate all the previous information as a reasonable as a way which we can then use to compute the new prior and posterior distribution. We also have another controller in the reinforcement learning module, whose goal is to keep all the information, but this time not for reconstructing the input stimuli and the reward, but instead of behaving well in the agent. Right, so this is like whatever we did before. Like this is like the LSTM in the PAC, whose goal is just to like remember or extract the part of the state which influenced the behavior of the agent, and it communicates with the memory in the same way. So it generates the read keys. The memory is then read. It's passed to the next time step of the controller, and it's used in generating the distribution over the actions, which are then sampled, and we can go further and further. So here we have talked about the prior, right? The posterior that's the encoder, and there is also the decoder. So what does the decoder what will it decode? Well, it will decode all of the input values. So it will decode the input image, the input text. It will try to decode the reward in the previous time step. It also tries to decode the previous action, like the previous action is included here, to the observation. This hippocampal representation theory means that it also tries to predict the observed return reward in this time step. And the value function, but the value function is something which we had on the input already. So this is what the algorithm, the pseudocode for the algorithm looks like. But maybe I will open it in the Merlin paper itself so that it's a bit bigger. So before we get there, let's glance through some technical details, which I don't think, I think that in the slides I only have the images yet. Yep. So let's... Oh, I'm sorry that I'm going everywhere. So let's go through the technical details. The encoders are quite straightforward. By the way, I said you a lie. I said that this V is the value function, which is definitely not the case. This V that's just the velocity. Right, because we are in the 3D environment and the velocities are also part of the inputs and the outputs. Yep. So that's one thing. As for the encoders are straightforward. So the image encoder is some number of convolutions in the neural networks. The velocity encoder is just the some fully connected layer. The actions are encoded using one-hot binary representations. The rewards as well, and the text is encoded by some small single-layer LSTM. So the encoders are like regular ones. The decoders, most of them are fairly similar as well. The image decoder is just the transposed convolutional neural network. The text decoder is just the LSTM generator. Other decoders are just linear layers. And this is for the reward, for the velocity, and for the action. Most interesting part is the part where we predict the return. So this is the hippocampal representation influence. So we try to... I have too many windows open. So here we try to predict this R. So this R is in the end really... return. Yes, it's really a return. So we try to predict the return, and this will influence these latent variables to like pay attention mostly to the parts of the images or to the input stimuli which influence the final behavior of the agent. So this is the reason why this representation might be useful to our agent, because it's so that it's simple to predict what the return will be if we are in this given state, right? So we don't have any explicit signal like gradient coming through this way, like this means the stop gradient sign, right? But instead what we do is this, we also include the return in the decoder. It's done in quite complex way. The decoder has two parts. First, it tries to compute the state value function, and then it tries to compute the advantages. Right, and then we train both of these parts separately. So we train the value function using the the estimated return as the target, and then we also train the advantages while trying to predict the observed return. This is very similar to these dualink networks in the rainbow, right, where we had also these two parts, the value prediction and the advantage prediction. And then what we did is we made sure that we always subtracted the mean of the advantages, so that we really force the model to actually use the value function for something. Here they take a bit different approach with the same effect, that when they train the advantages, they only train the advantages and not the values, and then they train the values separately. So these are the decoders. Then there are the technical parts of the memory, but as I said, it's like usual reading and writing. The only difference is this retroactive memory update, which also adds the information from the future time steps to the locations which were written to previously. The interesting part are the priors and the posteriors distribution, of course. Generally, the prior is selected to be a diagonal Gaussian distribution. So we generate the mu, so like the means and the diagonal covariances from the previous time step and the memory read in the previous time step, using, as you would expect, like one output and linear regression, one output and like no activation for the mean, and then exponentiation function for the covariance. The posterior distribution, the one which incorporates also the observation, takes the same inputs as the prior, takes the observation, encoded one. It also takes the prior itself, so it knows where is the part of the space where it should actually reside, right? And then just pass this through some MLP, so fully connected layers. We use the reparametrization trick as well. So I think these are the main part. As for the losses, so we need to compute the losses, the reconstruction loss, and the KL divergence loss. So the KL divergence loss is straightforward. We just compute the KL divergence between the prior and the posterior. The interesting is the reconstruction loss, because the reconstruction loss has a lot of parts. There is this image reconstruction, velocity reconstruction, action, text, reward, and return reconstruction losses. They worked like as you would expect. So there is the cross entropy loss using the Bernoulli output distribution for the image. Then for the return, there are these two parts, this which trains just the value prediction, and this part which trains the advantages without training the value through this term by itself. The reward is just the mean square error. The action is just the cross entropy. Velocity is just a number, so once again it's a mean square error, and the text is the cross entropy of the generated text. Yep. So now we can really go through the full algorithm. So as usual, we alternate in collecting experience and then updating the network. So this is one of the workers. This is like some PAAC version. So we have this distributed version actually. So we have some number of workers, and each worker like simulates some experience, and then it performs some kind of a training, in this formulation, we really compute the gradients and then synchronize them through some central parameter server. So compute or collect experience, then we start at the beginning of the episode or something, and then we start. What we need to do is we need to sample the action, right? So the policy, it depends on the LSTM for the policy, but also on the latent variable. So we get the latent variable by sampling it from the posterior distribution. The posterior distribution is computed from the observations, from the aggregation of the history, and the prior. And the prior is computed here from the aggregated information from the previous time step. So this allowed us to get an action. We then run the LSTM, which is used in the prior and posterior. We update the memory by using the Z, so we don't decide what to write. We write the generated latent variable. Then we also run the decoder and then store everything. Once we have done some number of steps, I think they used 15 or 20 steps as a window, we will be performing the update. So for that, we will need to estimate the return. For that, the authors use the generalized advantage estimation. So then they use truncated lambda return. So what we do is first we accumulate the observed rewards. We compute the temporal difference, like one step DD error. We use this recursive definition of computing the advantage. Here is the gamma for the discount, and lambda, which is the trace lambda. So this gives us the estimation of the advantage, and that allows us to compute the losses, right? Because we know the input stimuli, but what we didn't know was the estimated value function. So we have estimated the value function using this truncated lambda return, and we include all these many losses, yes, all these six losses. We add also the KL divergence part, and we also train the actor by using the reinforce algorithm, the policy gradient theorem, right? So there is this advantage here, which plays the role of Q minus V times the log likelihood of the performed actions, and we also, of course, add the entropy loss so that we actually perform some exploration even during the training. Yep, so we actually went through it. Do we still have some time? Yes. So let's look at some results. This is really a bit more challenging than what we have seen until now, but that's how it is with the complex architectures. There are a lot of things which will be put together. So first, let's start with some toy game. The toy game is the so-called memory game, which is like you just say XSO check. We have the 16 cards. You don't see them, right? Like they are flipped upside down, and it in each step, like it's just a one player environment, and in each step you choose a card and you flip it over. And the goal is to it's a memory game. So each card is twice present. So each image is there twice in the right on the board. And the goal is to flip the same images exactly to flip them consecutively. So in each time step, you just choose a card. It's flipped over. You can see what's there, and then it's flipped again. If you flip a card such that in the previous time step you flipped a different card with the same image, you get a positive reward. So it means that you can take these two cards off the game, you don't need to use them anymore, and you get some positive reward at that point, and the game continues. And if you are able to collect all of the cards, then the episode is finished, right? So it's like one player episode. Here you can see how the score evolves by using the RL-LSTM, this blue one, that just uses LSTM to remember all the previous information. Well, the interesting thing is that you can see that it actually starts training after 400 million environment steps. That's a lot, yes, that's a lot. It actually starts doing something and it's improving very slowly. The reinforcement learning with external memory, but which only uses RL to train the encoder and to train the memory retrieval, together with the DNC, does not really train. Like you can see that they are still down, but the Merlin architecture really starts training from the beginning. So using the external memory doesn't really improve anything. If you just let the information from the reinforcement learning guide its training, it doesn't really improve. Using LSTM is slightly better. You can see that in the end the network starts understanding what it should do, but if you train this memory-based predictor and the agent independently, you can see that you actually improve considerably. And this is like nearly the optimal value. So this is just a toy example. In the more advanced example, the goal, like you get a maze, and in that maze you should like collect some objects. You should like visit some interesting spots in the maze, and after some number of time steps, or maybe after collecting all of them, you start in some random location, and there is the new episode. So in each episode you should like navigate the maze, visit and visit the interesting places. So what you need to do is you need to remember how the maze looks like, and then like immediately understand where you are, and then find like the closest path between the interesting places. You can see how the score evolves. Similarly to before, the reinforcement, the using LSTM and already external memory without the MBP guidance doesn't really train much. So you can learn something, but at some point you will stop improving, while this Merlin architecture really seems to be doing better and better. Know that these are really extreme large quantities, so this is 2 billion of time frames to actually learn the navigation in the environment. There are a lot of experiments, but I will not spend much on them. But what is interesting is this part. So here you have the observations, and here are the parts which Merlin decides to actually incorporate in the encoder. Right? This means that if we are forced to predict returns in the decoder, then what the model does is that it concentrates on this red tree, which if visited will get the points, right? So the representation like disregards a lot of the surroundings and the green walls and the blue floors and so on, and instead you can see that it considers mostly the object which when visited will get you some positive rewards. If instead you would not try to predict the returns, you can see that the model will not learn to concentrate much on the goal object, right? There are some measurements here showing that different read heads play different quantities, but that's probably not that important. And here are some visualizations of what the priors, posteriors, and observation looks like. The alpha, that's the strength of the KL divergence factor. It is the threshold of whether you want to do the perfect reconstruction or whether you want the KL divergence in the objective to be low. Well, generally, the stronger it is, the worse the reconstruction is there, but it's not really surprising. Generally, you can see that even when the reconstructions are bad, the object learns to like look at the important parts. One of these important parts are these they call it skylines, right? Because to make the navigation easier, there is some background with some specific shape. So looking at that helps the agent to localize where exactly it is in the overall maze. So these are actually modeled, and then of course the objects which gives you large rewards are ideally also modeled if possible. But if they are too small, you can see that here they are not really part of the posterior. Yep. Similarly, to simplify the navigation, there are these markings on the walls, which are unique, so you can use them again to understand where you are. And you can see that the model like concentrates quite a lot on them as well. So it includes them to the posterior, and it probably wouldn't have done so that much or that strongly if the prediction of the return wasn't part of the goal. So I only have 12 minutes, so let's not go through more any more ablation experiments, and instead at least mention the FTV agent. So this Merlin architecture was then utilized in a paper 3 months later or something. The paper already was published in Science, I think. And what does it do? It evaluates the performance of a trained agent in 3D multiplayer games. So the game in question is Capture the Flag game, so using the Quake 3 engine. There are teams, each team consisting of 2 players, and the goal is to capture the flag. So the goal is to like get to the base of the opponent and then carry the flag and get it to your home base. There are various strategies. The people can go together, or one can be guarding their base and the other can go for the flag, whatever. The agents, they just get the visual observations, they get the velocities similarly to the Merlin case, and they get the rewards, which are some I would say small negative reward when you die, and some, no, it's not the dying is not part of it. You only get points when you capture the flag. So if you take the flag and then bring it home, then you get some positive reward. Yep. They also experimented with some reward shaping, but that's not it's not crucial. And you have a gun. You have a laser tag, and if you tag your opponent, they will respawn in their home base. To train the agent, they used an architecture very similar to the Merlin architecture, so what we just talked about. The interesting difference is that actually it uses 2 RNNs. One is the so-called fast ticking RNN, so that's like for each time step you get 1 tick, which is like some kind of micromanagement. And they also have like a slow ticking RNN, whose goal is to perform some kind of like a macro management, so like long term planning, right? So otherwise, if you only have this fast ticking RNN, it's difficult to keep the plan consistent for the long period. So these vRNNs somehow try to stay consistent, and we have seen the samples in the handwritten recognition. But here the games are very, very long, so it helps to actually have this hierarchy of the RNNs, so that we have a simple way, or the SGD is a simple way of having some kind of a long-term strategy. But the same memory-based predictor is used for generating this latent variable representations. Because we need to train some number of agents, we use the population-based training with the goal of first keeping some variability in the agents, in the population of the agents, and also by having a way which will allow us to tune the hyperparameters, like the strength of the KLA divergence and the speed of the slow ticking RNN and things like that. We discussed the population-based training already in the Impala paper, I think. So I will not mention it anymore. This is the overall architecture. The agent gets the input. There is this visual embedding, so that's the encoder. right? The previous reward and the previous action. Then this recurrent processing, that's the part which will generate the latent variables. Here is the agent itself. So we generate the policy and the baseline. And here we predict the rewards. The baseline is actually the prediction of the returns, and the pixel control, that's the decoders. The interesting, of course, is this recurrent processing. So either like we can do very simple recurrent processing, which would be just like two-layer LSTM, but instead they use these two time steps, and the recurrent processing is using this latent variable. So they have this what they call variational unit, which has this access to the external memory, and it generates the distribution of the prior and the posterior. So I will not really go much through it. Yeah, you can go through the paper if you want to see some details. Instead, let's get to some results. So after a long number of training, after like playing nearly 500,000 of games, they were able to come up with agents which really worked reasonably well, and by reasonably well I mean like superhuman. So after this full training, there was an evaluation with some people who trained a lot and tried to beat the computers, but in the end the trained agent performed better. Of course, because shooting is part of the performance, then it's important to make sure that the great reaction time is not the reason why the agent would be winning. So there was, it's in the supplementary, there were some ablation experiments showing that it's not the reaction speed which is making the agent to be better. So there was some limit incorporated in the speed of reactions, the possibility of reactions of the trained agents. But I cannot find it. But generally, they had even worse response times than what the humans did. The interesting thing is that during training or during the evaluation, the people didn't know whether they were playing with the AI opponent, with the AI teammate, or with a human teammate, and they also evaluated the cooperability or the ease of cooperation with the other agent, and the computer agents were easier to cooperate with than other players, at least according to this poll, right? So it seems that the AI agents learned to cooperate well with the agent. Well, maybe they don't have such a strong head, so it's easier for the humans to work with them. During the training, a lot of different strategies were observed. So they were the strategies which also people use. So following their teammate, waiting at the base of the opponents, or staying home and defending before the other people came. So there, these were really observed. So here you can see that the red one is the opponent base camping, the green is the home base defense, and the blue one is following their teammate. So changed during the course of the training. At some point it was following the other agent a lot, but in the end it stops following the opponent, the teammate, and instead it seems that some like there are like two roles that one of the players spends more time defending the base and the other tries to bring back the flag from the opponent base. So there are some specific these are the I'm not really sure if it makes sense to go in detail in the evaluation experiments. So maybe I won't. It was more sketchy than in the beginnings of the lecture, but that's how it's going to be now. So if you are interested in more details, then definitely go through the paper. There are also videos of the behaviors on YouTube and so on. And that leaves us with two more minutes until the end. So are there any questions? It's difficult to ask something after this. So this is one venue in which the development now goes, like to be able to process longer environments and the environments which are only partially observable. You have probably heard about this Alpha Star, the agent which plays StarCraft reasonably well, not completely superhuman, but exceedingly well, and generally, these architectures were used some kind of external memory to memorize a lot of the state are needed. And some nice way of actually coming up with a good representation is required as well. So the AlphaStar uses a lot of these basic building blocks as the Merlin describes. But what you usually also need when you play games with multiple agents, you need to have like a variability of your behavior. So you usually during training, you need to train not just one agent, but a whole flock of agents, which you like let match, like play each other, and then use some kind of like a tournament selection or some genetic algorithm to decide which of these agents you are going to keep in your pool and which of them you are going to stop using and replace them by some more successful ones. And then in the end, there is a question of how to combine ideally multiple agent into one bundle so that you can like utilize different strategies even during the inference. Like these latent variables and latent representations are like still being developed or still being worked on. Was a very nice paper which 3 months ago or something, which also trained some kind of latent model of the environment in case of the Atari games. And again, the model was trained like independently on the agent. So similar what the Merlin does, which trains the encoder without the gradient from the actor. I'm sorry, I read in the chat and I lost my trick. So what people are doing is they try to come up with nice, good latent representations of the environments, and then you can, for example, train the agent using the trained model only. A good thing about that is that you can do a lot of planning if you have a trained model, and you can do also much more training because if you only have the latent variables, not the images, then your policies can be much faster. And so that's, for example, what they do in this three-month-old paper. They represent the state by discrete variables, right? So instead of seeing an image, you see a vector with zeros and ones, still a discrete variables, and which they use to represent the state, and then the policy takes this discrete vector of zeros and ones as the input, and this actually performed better than the rainbow on the Atari, which is like interesting. So I will definitely talk about it in one of these, not really deep reinforced learning, but already the reading group lectures. There is some feedback. Thank you very much for the feedback in the chat, which is that it may be a good idea to actually repeat the last lecture. To have it the repeat at the end. Okay, so maybe have some summary slide or two summary slides saying what happened in the lecture and what the people, I think that's a good idea. You're true, that makes sense. And now that I have most of the slides, it would even be doable to write this slide beforehand. So thank you very much. I will try to do it in the deep learning in the winter semester to see how it works, and then maybe incorporate it also in the future lectures. Thanks a lot. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. If there are some questions, then of course, by all means, don't hesitate to ask. If not, then I wish you a nice evening. We will meet for the last time on the Wednesday practicals. There will still be the new assignments. I already have the assignment for working with the external memory ready from the last year, so it won't take forever for me to prepare it because it already exists. There is also the deadline for the AZ quiz assignment. So good luck with that if you are still working on it. And and we will also talk more about the exams and chocolates on the practicals. Also, if you have any feedback, any idea or something, then we can also use the practicals to talk about it. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy your evening and see you on Wednesday. Bye bye.